hear argument from petitioners in Martinez versus Valverde Medical Center.
This is the court. Mr. Reed J. Poole presenting argument for the petitioner. The petitioner deserves 7 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The primary issue in this case, from petitioner's perspective, is whether or not the Texas legislature intended to preclude a minor plaintiff who has satisfied the liability requirements of the Texas Tort Claims Act from pursuing a cause of action because of the impossibility of a legal requirement. In this state, this court and the Texas legislature have consistently protected the rights of minor children. In fact, the law in Texas dates back approximately 150 years, stating that not only are children excused from limitations for nurses until they reach the age of majority, but in fact they are without the legal capacity to sue.
You think they could do it, the legislature?
Could the legislature allow children?
No, disallow. Could they intentionally do what they've done here?
No. We don't believe that they could, because it would be inconsistent with 16.001.
Well, I mean, they can be inconsistent.
Well, that's true. I mean, they can, yes, Your Honor, they can do anything.
But I mean, could, like, were you here in the first case, can they do it and get away with it?
Well, not if this court is watching.
Well, on what basis, I guess I'm asking.
Because if the court did that, it would be taking away a cause of action that this court has recognized a minor plaintiff doesn't even have the right to bring until they reach the age of majority. In fact, in the Ruiz opinion, which, Justice Enoch, you wrote on that opinion, in that case, this court held that a minor plaintiff, or actually referred to a disabled, mentally incompetent person, but it also referenced minor plaintiffs, that there was a duty to protect those individuals. And that this court would not engraft something in the legislation that would harm that group of individuals. We ask the court to recognize that same protection today in looking at the Texas Civil Practices and Remedies Code in conjunction with the Texas Tort Claims Act. Now, the Texas legislature in 16.001 has codified the 150 years of jurisprudence from this court and recognized that a minor plaintiff operates under a legal disability and is incapable of initiating a lawsuit. In fact, if that minor does so, this court has recognized that that proceeding should be abated pending the majority of that minor plaintiff.
Have the tolling provisions of 16.001 been applied to limitations period other than those in subchapter 16?
Not that we can find, Your Honor. And in fact, that brings up a good point. The issue in this case is not whether 16.001 on its face allows for the tolling of a notice provision. The issue is whether, in looking at the absence of any language as to whether or not the legislature intended to allow minors to toll this notice provision, in the absence of any language in the Tort Claims Act, can we look other places to see what the legislative intent would be?
But you're not making a constitutional argument here. You're making an argument with respect to the statute.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And as in the first case, before you get to it, does the first part of the Court of Appeals opinion matter to you? Does it matter whether it's jurisdictional or it's just a requirement?
It does matter in some ways, Your Honor. And the reason it matters, well, let me first say why it may not matter. In Dubai, this court held and stated that there was a wrong assumption that something is functionally different about a non-common law proceeding, and that a non-common law proceeding, a statutory cause of action, traditionally is viewed in a harsher light. And in fact, that is what appears to have happened in the fourth court in this case, because even though the court below found that this was a non-jurisdictional requirement, the court still talks about strict compliance with the notice provision, citing to the Streetland case, which certainly looks to be decided on jurisdictional grounds prior to Dubai and not referencing that opinion.
Well, like the plaintiffs in the first case today, whether you lose by a plea or lose by a motion doesn't really matter to the plaintiff.
Well, it does. It does make a difference in this case, because, and in fact, the reason it makes a difference is if you are going to strictly apply the statute, then you're going to look at that statute and say, well, there is no tolling provision. So that's the end of our discussion. However, if you look at this on a summary judgment basis, then you are going to look at what is the effect of that statute upon the litigation itself. You've already gotten into the door, in other words. And that's what we really believe the Tort Claims Act does in this case. The important distinction to draw is when you look at the Tort Claims Act, under 101.025, that provision specifically is entitled Waiver of Governmental Immunity, Permission to Sue. You would expect that the legislature, under that provision, Waiver of Governmental Immunity, Permission to Sue, would set out when governmental immunity is to be waived. Well, that provision says sovereign immunity to suit is waived and abolished to the extent of liability created by this chapter. If you look at the liability provision of the Texas Tort Claims Act, it's not the notice provision. It's 101.021, and it's entitled governmental liability. And this is exactly the reasoning that the Fourth Court went through in finding that this was not a that the notice provision was not a jurisdictional requirement. Under 101.021, the legislature has stated that a governmental unit in this state is liable for personal injury caused by a condition or use of tangible personal property, with the irrelevant sections omitted. We have alleged in this case adequate facts to meet that jurisdictional prerequisite. We have met the waiver of governmental immunity and the permission to sue requirement under the Tort Claims Act. Interestingly, the notice provision is in a separate subchapter under Section 101. Subchapter B, which includes the waiver provision and governmental liability, is entitled Tort Liability of Governmental Units. But the notice provision is found in subchapter D, which is entitled Procedures.
So it's been put together. Legislature could condition waiver sovereign immunity on notice. It just didn't this time.
That's correct. And that's why my answer earlier, Your Honor, was that it would depend on how this court looks at Dubai. If the legislature was to take this and place it under the waiver of governmental immunity provision, then Dubai would come into play, and the question would be, do we have to look at these statutory prerequisites in determining jurisdiction? In this case, the court doesn't even have to do that, because the legislature has set up what constitutes jurisdiction and what doesn't. The notice provision is not part of that requirement. And so we would ask the court to affirm the Fourth Court's holding in that respect. Because the plain language of the statute creates a waiver of immunity through the showing of governmental liability as defined in the Act, petitioners have satisfied that burden. But the Fourth Court stated that because the cause of action in this case exists by virtue of the Texas Tort Claims Act, petitioners must strictly comply with the notice provision. We would assert to this court that that holding is inconsistent with the Fourth Court's earlier holding that this is not a jurisdictional requirement. There is no need for strict compliance in this case. The issue is, what was the intention of the legislature, and did the legislature intend that even though a minor has until the age of majority to bring a cause of action, that minor, who is legally incapable of initiating a lawsuit, must somehow perform the legal impossibility of giving notice?
I'd point out, though, 16001 says for the purposes of this subchapter, these are the legal disabilities, and of course this subchapter does not include the Texas Tort Claims.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. However, our position, again, is it's not that the language specifically tolls the notice provision. It's that the result would be absurd if the holding would be minors are incapable because they operate under a legal disability. They are incapable of giving statutory notice. However, they're going to have until they reach the age of 18 to bring their cause of action.
So, the bottom line is, your argument is that by not saying anything, the Tort Claims Act allows tolling for minority.
We believe the omission speaks volumes. And the reason we believe that is, first, because at the time that the Tort Claims Act, that this notice provision was created, was adopted by the legislature, there was already a large body of law that supported the proposition that a minor cannot bring a legal claim. Under those facts, if the legislature is presumed to know the law at the time that it enacts the statute, under that set of circumstances, why wouldn't the legislature, if it wanted to create an exception or say that minors' claims would not be told, why wouldn't the legislature have included that?
So we're not just deciding toward Texas Tort Claims Act. Your argument is that DTPA or challenging a liquor license or anything else, unless it specifically says anything about unsigned minors, it tolls them too.
We would say that, yes, Your Honor, to the extent that the law is very clear that an individual that is either an incompetent or a minor is unable to bring their cause of action. That is correct. Unless the legislature says otherwise, as it attempted to do under the 4590I. However, it didn't do that in this case, and it certainly could have if it had chosen to do so. But secondly, the reason behind the notice provision is important to consider. The reason, as this court has recognized, is to make the entity, the governmental unit, aware of the claim so that it can either defend it or try to settle it. That is the same reason, as we've discussed in our brief, for the statute of limitations provision. If you construe those consistent with one another, and in fact the Fourth Court even said that there was an analogy between the statute of limitations and the notice provision, if you construe those consistent with one another, then this notice provision should be told during that period of time because it does serve the same purpose as the statute of limitations. There is nothing inconsistent about holding the legislature to what it has said in another area of law. In fact, it would be inconsistent to believe the legislature intended to, on the one hand, create a cause of action, and on the other hand, take it away. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Ruth Molinas will present argument from respondent.
May it please the court. The issue in this case is whether minors are excused or should be excused from compliance with the mandatory notice provision found in Section 101.101, and the argument that petitioners necessarily would require this court to engraft some sort of tolling or exception requirement onto a statute, which this court's prior opinions regarding statutory construction clearly disallow such statutory amendments by the judiciary. The facts are undisputed in this case, at least the pertinent ones relating to the issue before the court. Unlike the first argument heard this morning, this does not involve a fetus. It involves a medical procedure performed at Valverde Regional Hospital to a three-year-old child. It's also undisputed that the first notice that Valverde had of the claim, which is what they have to have notice of, was a letter sent more than 6 months later. There was a medical malpractice suit brought against Valverde by the parents. Also sued were a physician and a nurse anesthetist. Now, Valverde filed a plea to the jurisdiction at the time all the claims were joined together. In answer to several of the questions in both cases, Valverde believes that viewing this as a jurisdictional issue is important because in the first case, there was a motion for summary judgment filed in that case, and it was 5 years later that the case got to a point where it could go to an appellate court to determine what was a dispositive issue, whether you look at it as a plea to the jurisdiction or by summary judgment. The dismissal became final because there was a severance. And so I guess from a practical standpoint in this case, right now, it doesn't really matter because the plea to the jurisdiction was sustained by the trial court and severed and then became final and could be addressed by a court of appeals. The difference occurs when the plea to the jurisdiction is denied, and then the governmental unit has a right to an interlocutory appeal to avoid the discovery, the trial, etc. So that answers that question. There are a number
what
of
reasons. What worries me about that is that the notice provision existed a long time before the interlocutory appeal provision. And we ought not to take a different view of the notice provision now than we would have taken of it 10 years ago when there wasn't an interlocutory appeal provision.
Well, in terms of whether or not this is a jurisdictional issue, I don't think the court has decided that in terms of this particular statutory provision. And I think that the court could find this to be jurisdictional in the context of a Tort Claims Act case without disturbing Dubai, for instance, because in the difference here is that with regards to a tort claim against a governmental unit, no court in the state of Texas has jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, over that claim unless there's been a waiver and or consent by the legislature. So it and the liability provision or the waiver provision that petitioner quoted from says that immunity from suit is waived to the extent of any liability created by this chapter. 101.021 is not the only liability provision. There are several others. And the fact that this has been placed in a procedural subchapter also is not dispositive. The fact remains that there is immunity or bar to liability if the notice provision is not followed, and that's undisputed.
So do you agree with the statement earlier? Every procedural requirement that is now or ever is put into the Tort Claims Act is jurisdictional?
No, I think a distinction could be made between, for example, I guess where I have some problems following it through is with a presentment requirement, for example, 60 days before suit, like in a local government code, which it's also in a different code, so it's a little bit different animal. But here, there is suit, you know, whether or not suit is filed has nothing to do with the notice provision. Or when suit is filed doesn't have anything to do with the notice provision. That notice has to be given 6 months after the incident giving rise to the claim, or there's no liability on the part of the state.
Yeah, but that doesn't have to be. You could file suit a week after the incident, give notice 6 months later. It doesn't. So it doesn't. You can't exactly. It's not a matter of it having to be pre-trial.
Well, but the suit is.
Let's say we have procedural. You got to have notice. You got to have limitations. This is the way you got to submit the jury question. This is the prejudgment interest. All requirements, all mandatory in the Texas Tort Claims Act. Which ones are jurisdictional? Which ones aren't?
Well, I don't think that something having to do with trial procedure would be jurisdictional. You're already in court.
So
it would seem somewhat inconsistent.
Well, you were already in court too until you raised the plea to the jurisdiction.
Well, now maybe I'm not understanding your question. What I'm saying is that in the first hypothetical that you stated where suit is filed a week later and a notice is given 6 months later, no notice is necessary because the suit is actual notice, and that's the only exception in the statute.
Yeah, my point was just that we can't necessarily say, oh, well, things that are pre-filing are jurisdictional and post-filing are not, because the filing itself might be noticed.
No, but I think that having certain trial procedures within the statute necessarily assumes a waiver of
legislature could condition waiver on particular trial procedures, couldn't it?
It'd be very
difficult. We waive sovereign immunity only if you try it in these kind of courts, for instance.
It'd be a retroactive
Say they set up a state court of claims, just like the feds have. You try it, but only in this court. I mean, they could certainly do that.
Yes.
And so, why should we do it? You're saying we should do it. We should decide what's trial and what's trial procedure and what's not, and therefore draw a line.
No, I guess what I'm saying is that the provision here is a mandatory one, and it might be a little easier to view it, if the court goes back and looks at the prior statutory language before it was codified into the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, because it is somewhat different, and that language is quoted in the Stanford case, and it's not stated in terms of the governmental unit being entitled to notice. It's stated that any person with a claim must.
Mandatory doesn't necessarily mean it's jurisdictional, does it?
I agree. For example, in situations 4590I and the DTPA, this court has held that although the language there about 60 days notice is written in mandatory terms, the purpose of it can be fulfilled by abatement.
I guess looking at the structure of the Tort Claims Act, the section 101.101 is notice. The very next section, 101.102, says commencement of suit, but the first provision of the venue says it must be brought in the state court in the county in which the cause of action or part of the cause of action arises. Clearly, that's mandatory, but that's not jurisdictional.
True, but also if it's brought in the wrong venue, a motion to transfer venue is filed, it doesn't affect the liability of the state. This provision, however, does.
You might be entitled to summary judgment based on the notice. That doesn't mean, or lack of notice, that doesn't mean that it's jurisdictional. You can, essentially, you can waive venue just like you can waive notice. When the state doesn't raise venue, and you can't raise for first time on appeal and say, they filed in the wrong county, let's start out with it. Seems to me the same thing is true in the notice provision. It's not something you can raise for the first time on appeal.
Well, then I guess I have trouble also then with if the 101.021 failure to comply with that is a jurisdictional provision, it's a pleading issue, and so that couldn't be raised. That could be raised later. Under the cases that say you must plead yourself within the Texas Tort Claims Act, and if your suit is such that there's no way you're going to bring it in within the waiver, for example, that the facts show it clearly wasn't.
Well, that's different. I'm talking about look at where these procedures are. There's no provisions in there's commencement of suit, which includes venue, certain other requirements. And it's one thing to say your set of facts, you cannot allege use of tangible personal property or respect if you're out. That's one thing. But isn't it another thing to say the fact that you didn't give notice is jurisdictional? In other words, I have a hard time seeing how the state can wait till the Supreme Court of Texas to say for the very first time after it's gone to the trial court, the court of appeals, no jurisdiction because they didn't give notice. It seems to me that's something that can be waived if it's not timely raised, just like venue. If it's timely raised, you're entitled to rely on it, but that doesn't make it jurisdictional.
I guess I think in the context of the Texas Tort Claims Act, this court should resolve any ambiguities in that statutory scheme in favor of immunity. That's what the court said in Wichita Falls. And so I guess looking in part because the waiver, the waiver is not presumed and the waiver is not liberally construed. The waiver is as narrow as possible in the context, only in the context of the Tort Claims Act and waivers of sovereign immunity. And so maybe that would be a way to distinguish it from these other instances and other statutory schemes that don't involve that sort of waiver of immunity from suit. Because, for example, cities, they're immune from liability, but they've never been immune from suit.
So you win on summary judgment or plea to the jurisdiction. We should do this. This should be jurisdictional so we can keep having all of these come up by interlocutory appeal, which we're being flooded with. But that's the reason we should make sure it stays jurisdictional.
Well, actually,
any stronger reason from a judicial perspective?
Well, I feel, technically speaking, it could be completely avoided in this case because it's never been argued. I mean, I realize that with the two cases together, I'm prepared to address it.
We did not file. So jurisdiction can be raised on appeal, but no jurisdiction can be raised for the first time on appeal, but jurisdiction can.
I'm sorry. No.
You're saying it's waived. I mean, jurisdiction is not normal.
No, I guess what I'm saying in this case, there was no complaint made about the Court of Appeals ruling on jurisdiction. In other words, we did not file a petition for review and ask for the greater relief from this court, which was an affirmance of the dismissal. We were going to go down and do what the Court of Appeals instructed us to do and file a motion for summary judgment. And in fact, just out of curiosity, I did a count up of the cases involving these issues of notice and exceptions from the notice requirements, discovery rule, et cetera, and most of them did arise in the context of summary judgment. And so, since this court has said that jurisdictional issues can be raised either way, and evidence can be, I don't really have anything other to add other than what the state argued this morning.
Why shouldn't a tolling provision apply, whether based on Chapter 16 or based on the law that was in existence from this court and others prior to the enactment of Chapter 16, to permit somebody who has no legal capacity to sue sometime and bring their claim after they reach the majority?
Well, if the court goes back and looks at virtually all of those cases, whether it's involving legal disability or the discovery rule, they are decided in the context of constitutional challenges, and in particular, mostly open court challenges to a statute of limitations or some sort of provision. And here, that sort of challenge is simply not possible and has not been brought. And the Kreider case points out, I think very correctly, that all of the cases against municipalities where there was an exception for minority, it was that it violated the open courts provision, the charter provision did. Here, on the other hand, there is no common law right to sue the state, which is a necessary requirement for a constitutional challenge. So I think it's for the legislature to determine what exceptions to this statutory requirement to a cause of action that could only exist through creation by the legislature, to determine if there are, in fact, going to be any exceptions. And the same argument can be made with the discovery rule. The same argument can be made with someone who claims a mental disability. The fact remains that no one can sue the state unless it consents. And so, to the extent that the waiver of immunity is less than would be, in other words, you would have less of a right or less of a remedy than against a private person, is not a reason to engraft a provision onto this statute that doesn't exist. It's for the legislature to do so. And there's a couple of the cases, I believe Greenhouse is one, and also the lower court, Martinez itself, discusses unfairness and points out that the fact that there is some unfairness in cases against state entities is for the legislature to deal with. We believe that the court should affirm the Court of Appeals and quite frankly not reach the jurisdictional issue in this case because it wasn't raised by either party. And if there are no other questions,
thank you, Kim.
Some time back.
May it please the court, Mr. Rex Pendleton, present a rebuttal for the petitioner.
May it please the court, counsel. I would first like to look at the big picture first and then relate some arguments to specifics, Your Honor. This case is about children. We have no legal capacity to comply with the procedure in the statute. The issue that is presented to this court is whether the legislature intended to require children to perform an impossible action, or is that absurd result to be avoided by this judiciary, this court, or the judiciary, applying legal principles that have been applied in the past and that had been codified and written by the legislature to toll notice as it does for limitation periods of which notice is a part. And of course, we believe it is the latter. Just as words used in a vacuum mean nothing, the absence of words mean nothing unless considered in the context of the remainder of the statutory law. This is important in regard to the issue of the fact that there is no notice provision, there is no tolling provision in the Texas Tort Claims Act. Secondly, please understand that the Texas Tort Claims Act has no limitation provision. Does that mean that there is unlimited limitation? Of course not. We apply the limitation provision in Chapter 16. And to the same extent, there is every reason to apply the tolling provision of Chapter 16 here. The legislature could not have intended the absurd result because of having no tolling provision, but engrafting a limitation provision from Chapter 16. Just because they're in different parts of the legislation does not mean that a court has its hands tied and has to reach an unfair result because it cannot apply the entire body of statutory law. That's all we're asking the court to do, is to apply the whole body of statutory law. This court has stated that the notice provision presupposes the existence of a person who is capable of complying with notice. Now, that is stated in McCrary against City of Odessa, which we cite. Yes, it is a constitutional case. No, this is not. Yes, it is a city case. This is not. But the principle of having someone who is capable of complying is completely applicable. And as in Ruiz against Conoco, where Justice Hex stated that a tolling statute reflects a considered legislative judgment that in enumerated circumstances, the strong policy in favor of a prompt disposition of disputes, which is the purpose of limitation and notice, must give way to the need to protect a plaintiff, here a child, who is unable to protect himself or herself. That need will continue so long as the plaintiff remains incompetent. This child is incompetent and incapable of performing that action.
So the tolling provisions apply to the limitations provision as well of the Texas Tort Claims Act.
Yes.
Have to.
We're saying that the tolling provision applies to the Texas Tort Claims Act, just as the limitation provision applies from Chapter 16 because it's nowhere found in the statute itself. The legislature chose not to put it in there, and therefore you look to other parts of the law to reach your conclusion. The case presents a circumstance very much like in Bridgestone and Firestone against Glenn John, where words, no matter how plain, will not be construed to cause a result that the legislature certainly could not have intended. This is Justice Heck concurring at page 135. The legislature could not have intended to exclude children who have no capacity to give notice. Now, mind you, there was some statement made about, well, couldn't a next friend give notice? Certainly. But a child has no capacity herself to give notice. The child has no capacity herself to file the suit. And therefore, there is a preclusion of a requirement that the child do so. The meaning of the words in the statute depend on the context. And an essential part of the context is the purpose of the words as used. And once a court has ascertained that purpose, the court should enforce that purpose, even if that application seems inconsistent with the statute's strict letter. This was Justice Phillips writing and quoting Justice Joe Greenhill's opinion in 1979 in State against Terrell, a Tort Claims Act case. That is what we're faced with here. You apply the law to have a just result consistent with the purpose of the statute. There is an absence of a provision for tolling, but there's a body of law that applies tolling. Because there is no statutory purpose to require children to do an impossible act to give notice, the act reasonably should be applied, consistent with Section 16 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, to told the notice requirement during minority. I stated earlier, the legislature could have written a two-year statute of limitation, and the Tort Claims Act could have written a provision regarding tolling, but both were not necessary. The Crowder case and the discovery rule cases found that the notice provisions were jurisdictional. That was a complete disregard of this court's opinion in Dubai. And for that reason, those cases are not sound. The court below, on the one hand, found that the jurisdictional requirement, that there was no jurisdictional requirement for notice, and yet they turned right around and inconsistently found that, and wrung it their hands and said, citing Streetman, which was a common law attempt to it being grafted on a statute, that, gee, we're really sorry that this is unfair, but we can't do anything. The court below was mistaken. The judiciary can do something. It can apply the entire body of statutory law, including Chapter 16, to find that there was no purpose to exclude children, and that the statute must be applied consistent with its purpose. That is the basic tenet of statutory construction, to ascertain the purpose and apply the statutory law consistent with that purpose to reach a just result. It could not possibly be a just result in this case to deny a child the right to bring a cause of action, to give notice where it's impossible for her to do that. And I don't believe that this court would want to so hold. We ask the court to please reverse and remand the case.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments for today, and the marshal will adjourn.